Hello, I'm Tebadi Motla. Welcome to this first episode of For Fact's Sake, a monthly podcast by the Center for Information Integrity in Africa, or CINIA for short. In an era of information operations, disinformation, and societal polarization, the CINIA stands at the forefront of safeguarding democratic values and defending trust across the continent. The proliferation of misinformation and harmful content on digital platforms poses significant risks to democracy and social cohesion. Here on For Fact's Sake, we aim to stimulate public engagement around these threats and issues. In this edition, misinformation is everywhere, and it can be scary, dangerous, and even life-threatening. Misinformation is peddled in politics, health, debates about climate and the environment, during major crises or emergencies. You come across misinformation across all spheres of societies, and even when it comes to stories about sport and celebrity. It is dangerously used around elections and other political campaigns across the globe. We have seen misinformation surface here in South Africa during recent xenophobic attacks, which ended in death and destruction. It was also prevalent during COVID-19 with disastrous consequences. It has become so omnipresent that often only the most outrageous examples get our attention.
Pinocchio, why didn't you go to school?
School? Well, I...
Go ahead, tell her.
I was going to school till I met somebody.
Met somebody?
Yeah, two big monsters with big green eyes. Oh, look! My nose! What's happened?
Perhaps you haven't been telling the truth, Pinocchio.
Excuse me, turn the lights down. Turn the lights down. And just put this on. It's right behind you. Johan.
At the White House this past week, an Oval Office meeting between President Trump and South African President Cyril Ramaphosa that began cordially took a turn when Trump started to play a video which showed a row of hundreds of white crosses along a country road.
These are burial sites right here. Burial sites. Over 1,000 of white farmers.
Trump told the South African president every cross was the burial site of a murdered white farmer in his country. This was not true. The footage was from a demonstration following the deaths of two people killed on their farm. Their killers were convicted and sentenced. But the truth has not stopped President Trump from trying to bolster the false claim that there was a genocide happening against white farmers in South Africa.
But you do allow them to take land.
No.
You do allow them to take land.
No, nobody can take land.
And then when they take the land, they kill the white farmer. And when they kill the white farmer, nothing happens to them.
No. There is quite...
Nothing happens.
It's Consider This from NPR. President Trump's spreading of this false claim that South Africa is perpetrating a genocide against its white inhabitants... It's just the latest example of misinformation making its way from corners of the internet into presidential statements or even policy.
Oh, look! My nose!
The U.S. election was rigged, which it was, after they rigged the U.S. election.
Why do you say that?
I say that because all the empirical evidence points to the fact it was rigged.
Andrew Tate is a former Big Brother contestant turned conservative viral star. He's accused of spouting lies around the 2020 election and making misogynistic comments. He's now been cancelled from YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram.
India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has been in power for over 10 years, and his Hindu nationalist politics has won over large swathes of the Hindu-majority country. Over the past decade, the space for freedom of speech has been shrinking, while disinformation and hate speech has exploded on social media, at times provoking all-out violence.
What you get to say, how you get to say, how much you get to say has been constantly going down. One slip, and we know that we are done for.
What's happened?
Perhaps you haven't been telling the truth, Pinocchio.
The mission here is to remind South Africans that we are not going to have borders in our own countries that are made by illegal foreigners. Because there's a thing now. South Africans can't just walk freely in Sunnyside. South Africans can't just walk freely in Hillbrow. Now we are here as South Africans to walk our streets. These are our streets. They don't belong to anyone. They don't even belong to government, because government is the people and the people are here. Number one. Number two, we are here to ensure that the same bylaws that we are expected to enforce in Soweto and every other place in South Africa are enforced in dominated areas of illegal foreigners. Let that moment come. I don't want tomorrow they must say, I was inciting violence, I said 1, 2, 3. While the cops are here protecting illegal foreigners who have entered and locked themselves in our South African-owned buildings.
Oh, look!
See, I know you're watching. We spoke about it.
With who?
After this guy, it's me. Kiki lying.
You're out of line, man. Oh, you want to date Minnie?
Yeah. Or one, yeah, le bamba lo re le nakise. Lena naja.
Bro, I'm telling you, man, there's got to be something wrong with her. Like, maybe it smells or something, bro.
No. Yeah.
You know this happens, dog. It happens, bro.
Perhaps you haven't been telling the truth, Pinocchio.
Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
Can you give us a question?
I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you stay categorical?
You are fake news.
Flu vaccines increased the odds by 36% of getting COVID-19. If you've ever had a flu vaccine, you were injected with coronaviruses.
Misinformation is increasingly threatening public discourse globally, and South African universities are grappling with how best to educate students in misinformation literacy. But just how literate are young people when it comes to misinformation? And what can educators do about this? Two academics have recently explored such literacy among students, and in their research have identified a growing tension. Young people often struggle to balance healthy skepticism with outright cynicism towards the media. This comes from a comprehensive, nationwide study involving focus group discussions with 77 students across 8 universities in South Africa, spanning diverse geographical and socioeconomic contexts. Complementary to these discussions were detailed interviews with educators who delivered media literacy lessons using materials specifically developed by the fact-checking organization Africa Check. These sessions provided valuable insights into students' perspectives, educators' challenges, and the broader implications for misinformation literacy education. Findings from the study, which were recently published in African Journalism Studies, highlight a significant divide. Some students became more critical, discerning media users who are capable of assessing source credibility and recognizing bias. Others developed deeper cynicism, often withdrawing from media entirely due to mistrust. Quite a gloomy picture in these especially dark times. But the study also aimed to investigate effective strategies for teaching misinformation literacy. That is what we are discussing with the two authors of the study in this edition of For Fact's Sake. Let's ask them to introduce themselves.
Hello, my name is Herman Wasserman. I am a professor at Stellenbosch University in South Africa and also the director of the Center for Information Integrity in Africa at the same university.
I am Danny Madrid Morales. I am a lecturer at the University of Sheffield in the UK. I'm also a leader of the disinformation research cluster at the same university where we study disinformation around the world.
Please define misinformation literacy so that my granny can understand it.
Misinformation literacy really is the ability for people to identify different types of inaccurate media content. In other words, it teaches people to know and to recognize when something is false information, and also how they can go about to check that information, whether that is a WhatsApp message that you've received, some website that you stumble across, an email, or maybe even just something that somebody told you. So misinformation literacy is really the set of skills that you acquire to be able to discern false and information from truthful information.
Thank you, Herman. And what forms of misinformation are there?
This one is a tricky one, right? Because anything can be misinformation about any topic that you can think of. There are some people or some media sources that will try to distribute content that's not accurate. For example, think about COVID-19. When the pandemic was around us, there was a lot of health disinformation or misinformation, depending on which word you want to use. So that was pretty much everywhere around us. When there's a what we call an information vacuum, when there's lack of information about a topic, there tends to be a space where misinformation flourishes. And that can happen around different concepts or topics. Think about elections, think about politics, think about when there's a big crisis or a big event that is happening and people don't really know what's going around them. That's when we tend to see misinformation. Think, in the case of South Africa, for example, when we had the sort of different waves of xenophobic attacks, and some of the communities were affected by xenophobia, that is a space where misinformation also flourishes. Whether it's people who very intentionally want to distribute falsehoods about what's going on because they have some sort of political gain or aim that they have, but also because sometimes things happen so fast that the media, the authorities are not able to really provide accurate information. So we could make a long list, health, politics, gossip, celebrities, all sorts of areas could have misinformation. Obviously, some are more impactful than others, but it really affects pretty much everywhere around us.
Thank you, Danny. The other question that I have is that, should we be scared of it? Should we be scared of misinformation?
Some parts of misinformation are quite scary. If you think about what happened with COVID-19 again, and this is an example that we use often because it's one that really affected many of us. So there were some sources of and types of misinformation that really were quite scary. When people were being told to use certain types of health approaches to cure COVID or to prevent COVID, that can have really negative consequences on your health, on the health of the people around you. So in those cases, misinformation is something that we should be somewhat scared of. But then other areas, misinformation is in this very gray area, right? Think when humor gets mixed with false information. Sometimes some people might use humor to criticize politicians in areas where they cannot really criticize them directly. And in those cases, probably it's not something we should be scared of. Sometimes it's even good sometimes to have a little bit of humor around things that we cannot discuss openly. But it really depends. I guess that the answer to many questions is going to be depends.
Mm-hmm.
This question also goes directly to this topic of our study, and that is that misinformation literacy is actually also aimed at making misinformation a little less scary because it aims at empowering people. If you feel that you're overwhelmed by misinformation and there's such a lot of it out there, it can be very scary. And as Danny has said, there are some real scary consequences. But the idea with misinformation literacy is that it aims to give a bit of power back to audiences. If you know how to spot it and you know how to counter it, it can become a little scary, and then you don't have to feel hopeless about it.
Are there misinformation literacy classes at South African universities?
We ran a study a couple of years ago with a project with Africa Check. Africa Check is this fact-checking organization that's based in Joburg that tries to promote misinformation literacy among the general population in South Africa. So we did that study, and we actually did a survey, and we asked university professors about this. And the findings are quite interesting, right? So we asked them different aspects of media literacy, and we asked them, is this currently taught? So I'll give you an example. So one of the elements of media misinformation literacy is being able to use tools to check whether something is accurate or not. For example, you can do things like Google reverse search, where you can upload an image to Google, and then Google tells you whether this image has appeared before. So this specific type or competency within misinformation literacy is not really commonly taught in South African universities. But there's other things such as knowing the consequences of misinformation. Almost 60% of the people we talk to, those are university teachers across South African universities, said that that's taught somewhere. So the answer to your question is, as a module or as a course or as a subject, misinformation literacy isn't taught. There's no university where you will be able to register or sign up for a course on misinformation literacy. But some of the competences within misinformation literacy are embedded in the curriculum. But we found that some parts of it that are quite needed are still not taught at universities.
I would maybe add to that just to say that also some of this has to do with skills, and others has to do with also understanding the broader context within which misinformation takes place. And in our study, we also try and make a distinction between broader media literacy and specific misinformation literacy. So there's when you talk about media literacy, and that is, for instance, understanding who owns the media, how does that ownership impact on the news that we receive? How do people engage with news, etc.? Some of that is very well entrenched in a lot of the media studies and journalism studies curricula at South African universities. And increasingly, misinformation literacy forms a part of that. But as Danny has said, we didn't find any specific module that deals specifically with misinformation literacy as a distinct competency that is different from media literacy in the broader sense.
Findings from your study highlighted that some students became more discerning and more critical media users. They are capable of assessing source credibility and recognizing bias. Are there any common denominators between these students?
Our study, just for a bit of context, right, asked students to react to a media literacy class that they were attending. And at the end of this, we asked them different questions about how they felt about that class and how what consequences or what impact they thought it had on them. Now, the ones that at the end of this class thought they were more critical or more discerning were generally students who had what we would call a high level of political interest. So, for example, students who in their daily lives are quite likely to get exposed to political content, who are seeking information and consumers of news on a regular basis. It doesn't really matter where they get their news from so much. But some of them, for example, are listeners of podcasts. Some of them like to watch content on YouTube. Some of them watch the evening news on SABC. But generally, I would say the ones that are more critical and more discerning are those that on a regular basis, they get exposed to news content, right? And they are quite avid users of news. We did not see that much of a sort of a class divide or a geographical divide. So our study includes South African students from different provinces, and we did not see a big difference in that area. So what was the main common characteristic was this desire to be exposed to news content on a regular basis. I guess that would be the main denominator of these types of students.
I would say that also one of the differences that we did see between different universities, and we know that South Africa is a very unequal country, and that also we do see that also at university level, where some students arrive at university at first year with already some background that they might have picked up at school, some skills that they've learned or that they've maybe even taught themselves because they've had computers at home, and you know, others arrive at university without any background in that regard, not as confident necessarily in terms of navigating their way. So this is also something that came out in our discussion with some of the educators at school level, is the limitations of misinformation literacy is also linked to demographic factors and inequality. So when we contend with this problem of misinformation, we have to do this within a specific context. And our context in South Africa is very different from a context such as the US or some European countries, where you might be able to assume more access to the internet, more you know, personal ownership of laptops and iPads and so on. So we do see some of that coming out through the school level as such. So this is something that I would say that we realize that you would have to contend with this inequality when you try to deal with the consequences of misinformation and also try to help people empower themselves to deal with themselves.
In your study, you also found that there are other students who developed deeper cynicism. They are often withdrawing from media entirely due to mistrust. What did these students say caused their retreat into media cynicism?
The problem that we came across is that sometimes it is not a lack of awareness of misinformation that is the problem. It is a lack of empowerment or a lack of sense that they can do something about this. So often students are very aware of the problem of misinformation in various guises. That often has to do on a very personal level with things like scams that they receive, dubious links that they get sent to click on, or even messages that family members send to them that they know are untrue. The problem, however, is that they sometimes feel so overwhelmed by this problem and also so overwhelmed with all the information that is out there that they do not necessarily know how to respond to it and how to empower themselves to make a difference and to counter it. The result of that is that students would then just say, well, there's so much misinformation there, I'm better off not believing anything, or I'm better off withdrawing and just making my own decisions about what I want to consume. And that is where that sort of cynicism comes in. A critical attitude would say, I'm able to distinguish between true and false. I have skills to fact check certain things, and therefore I can try and counter this. But a cynical attitude is one where you throw up your arms in the air and say, I can't do anything about this. There's too much out there. I'd rather withdraw.
I think that all the students who ended up developing this more skeptical view of the media were also those that generally felt distrust in institutions more broadly, right? For example, people who in their everyday life have been disadvantaged by different parts of society. Maybe it is that in their communities, some of the services that politicians say they would deliver have not been delivered. Or maybe it is people who have seen their parents or their relatives suffer some injustices because of abuses that have happened in the broader socio-political context. So it is people or it's students who in their everyday life already get exposed to a lot of the everyday sort of inequities and inequalities of South African society. And that has a big impact in how they process news content, right? For example, we had lots of students who were telling us, oh, when elections come, there's all these politicians that will send us SMS and texts and WhatsApp groups and so on that say, oh, when we win the elections, we are going to bring this and this and this to your community. Maybe we are going to provide better sanitation. Maybe we're going to fix the roads. Maybe we are going to solve issues with crime. And then people vote for them, and then there's no translation of those promises into reality. So that develops an increased level of distrust. And then they establish this connection, right? When one of the things that we did with these students, so we brought them together in what we call a focus group, right? So we brought 6, 7, 8 students around a table, and we asked them, so give me an example of misinformation that has happened around you. And many of the students said, oh, I remember when there were elections last year. We did this right after there were local elections in South Africa. So, and they said, oh, this politician would say, I promise that if I win, I will do this and this. And they, well, that's an example of misinformation to them, right? It doesn't really have to come through the mainstream media. It doesn't really have to come through social media like Twitter and so on. It maybe sometimes just a message that gets sent to them by a relative that forwards a message that comes from a WhatsApp group and so on. And that's an example of what we label everyday misinformation. That is, falsehoods that are around us. And then when we have the feeling that they're around us all the time, then that leads to some students feeling very skeptical about all the information that they get.
The point that Danny makes here is an important one, also because this lack of trust in institutions and processes that people experience because of their everyday lives then has a circular effect. Because that is also how misinformation, people that peddle misinformation often prey on that. They would then say, you cannot trust the elections, for instance. You cannot trust the political system. Around the world, what we have seen, and certainly I think also in our context, is that when people lose faith in these institutions, or they, there's a lack of trust in democratic institutions and processes, that creates an inroad for peddlers of disinformation to further exploit that. And that is why it is so important to, you know, media literacy and empowerment to rebuild that trust in these institutions. For instance, something that we've also seen in other research that we've done is where misinformation agents then target things like the Independent Electoral Commission and the courts and so on.
Let's talk about the danger of blanket cynicism with many of the students that you interviewed. You suggest some strategies to deal with that. Let's look at one of them. Which one did you believe that is the most important?
Today, in most South African high schools, media literacy is taught to all students. Right. So we have reviewed the curricula for live orientation, which is a subject that is very controversial in South Africa. Some people love it and some people hate it, right? But live orientation includes some media literacy content that all South African high schoolers get when they go through high school. Now, what happens is in that subject, misinformation literacy, which is this aspect of media literacy, doesn't really get talked about. So what we suggest is that when and if there's any possibility of reviewing some of the core curricula that is set by the government, right, when the curriculum are approved, that we need to embed some of these specific misinformation literacy capabilities into that curriculum. Because, for example, many South African students already learn about media ownership or who owns the media has an impact in the content that they distribute, which is an important part to learn. But it's also important to learn broader things about, so what do I do when I suspect that something might not be true? What are the tools that I have as a media consumer to feel more empowered to go and see what things can I do to verify that that's true or not true? And that's something that maybe wasn't needed 10, 15 years ago so much because there was a monopoly on the information production in a few hands. And we tended to trust more those very few sources. I'm not saying that everything that they said was true, right? But there was no, as a society, we didn't feel the need to teach us and the younger generations these skills. But in the current context, where there's so many news producers and sometimes it's difficult to learn what is true and what is not, it is important that we start embedding some of these skills in the curriculum. And the best way to do it is to do it at an early age. We know that not every people will end up going to university, for example. So if we only teach it at university level, not everyone will be learning those skills. And one of the things that's interesting from the discussion that we had with the students was many of them thought the earlier we start teaching these things, the better. And we asked them, how young do you think people should be? And some people said 10, 11, 12, because people are getting a mobile phone sometimes or access to a mobile phone at a quite early age. And that's a very clear entry point to this information. So that's why we suggest that if we embed misinformation literacy specifically, right, the set of competences that are very specifically aimed at being able to detect misinformation, that would be a good starting point. It will not solve the problem, but it will be a good starting point.
One of the things on that point that we've picked up from our interviews with some of the educators is that, you know, this, although this approach is really important to start early, again, we're back at the South African context where integrating this at a school level already then presents a new set of challenges. Because there are such vast differences and vast inequalities in South African schooling. So to start with, you have areas that have better access to Wi-Fi, even something basic like access to electricity. Then you have not even started talking about individual access to phones and computers and laptops. So if you come with a universal strategy of saying, let's devise a curriculum where students take their laptops home and work on a project, you know, that is unrealistic because not everybody has that, or some people might have it and some others might not, or where you assume necessarily that the educators themselves are trained and empowered enough to teach learners about digital literacy. So one of the things that we clearly picked up from our interviews is that there's no one-size-fits-all solution. And then when we do want to design effective interventions from a younger age, we have to be very cognizant of the social, cultural, and economic conditions in which these strategies will be applied. And so we'd have to look at the context, we'd have to look at who has access, what are their habits, how do they use the media, what does the educational system look like, what do schools look like. And so there's a need for really sort of granular understanding of the South African system in order to make effective interventions.
You are listening to For Fact's Sake. I'm Dibadi Modla, and we are talking about misinformation literacy with Herman Wasserman and Danny Madrid Morales and how to make it work effectively. You then suggest that there should be a continuous adoption of media literacy curricula to keep pace with misinformation trends and technological advances. You just mentioned that. But we realize that it is changing as well. And then these misinformation trends and technological advances also change. How will this work? How will the change come into play in terms of dealing with misinformation trends?
That's a very tricky question, right? We've seen in the last 3-4 years that what was misinformation 3 years ago is very different from what it is today. If you look back 3 years ago, AI was not anywhere around us. And now AI and all these generative AI tools are everywhere around us. So what is important to recognize, and in connection to what Herman was saying, right, it's important to learn the context, understand what are the main issues that are affecting South African society, but also to be aware that as a problem that evolves very quickly, we need to be flexible in how we design this curriculum. One of the issues that we identified as part of this study, and this study forms part of a much larger project that we did over a couple of years with Africa Check. And one of the things that we did as part of this project was to talk to lots of educators, not just at universities, but also at high schools and in South Africa. And one of the things that they were saying is that sometimes the way the curriculum is set, again, life orientation has very clear instructions to educators on what they have to teach, but that is quite strict. And for this curriculum to be changed, it requires a lengthy process, a consultation process, a sort of an agreement across different institutions. Now, that doesn't work well when the problem keeps changing very fast. Say, if we do a revision of the curriculum today and say, oh, we have to teach ChatGPT today because that's the thing now. But maybe it will not be the thing to be concerned about in 5 years' time. So what do you do? If you are saying, oh, the curriculum says I have to teach ChatGPT today, but not 5 years down the line, then you have an issue. So what's important is find a way to be flexible, right? Find what are the underlying competences that we must make sure that students learn. And then obviously finding the ways to embed that technology within schools. Herman explained that very clearly, that not every single school in South Africa has access to the same technology. And that became very, very clear during COVID, when many students had to go back home. And then it was very difficult for some of the families to be able to do some of the homework or the activities when they had no access to some of the technology that they had at school. So this flexibility is quite important to create something that works now, but also down the line.
And then just a quick addition to this, but also something that interesting that we picked up is that this is not only a technological problem. So this is also a social and a cultural problem often. So what, you know, students told us as well is that you might get something sent onto you by your auntie or your grandfather or maybe some respected faith leader in the community. But then because of cultural norms and because of respect for elders and so on, people don't want to correct them necessarily. And then often that misinformation goes unchecked. Even if they know that this is false or wrong, they would not necessarily respond and correct them. So when we address this problem, you know, as Danny has said, there's certain underlying skills and there are also certain underlying attitudes that I think stand in the way often of solving this problem or improving people's misinformation literacy. So it is really a holistic problem that we have to tackle through schooling, through access to technology, through the school system itself that often, you know, is problematic. And then also to wider, widespread attitudes and cultural, social cultural norms.
Mm. You also suggest that students should be directly involved in media production. Will that really work?
Actually, there's quite a bit of research that has been done in that area. For example, and that has a long, long history. Say you bring a group of students from Limpopo, right? And you bring them together to some lessons or some classes where you teach them how to use certain equipment, how to create a new story, how to interview people. And as they learn these skills, as they learn how to approach people and ask the right questions, and then they have to make editorial decisions, right? So maybe they record an interview for 10 minutes and they have to decide which parts they include and which ones they exclude. So it is by being involved in that process, even students that are not going to produce sort of broadcast ready level content, right? We're not trying to get that. But by involving students in the practical everyday decisions that happen in media production, it's evidence that that has an impact on how they understand the media. And they are better equipped to process information, right? Because now they understand what happens behind the scenes when news content is produced. And that's one of the things that this skepticism slowly disappears, right? If you don't know how the media come to create the content that they create, you might start believing all these conspiracy theories that there's all these dark hands that have control over everything that happens in the media. When you start understanding that journalists are humans that have to make decisions like we all do in our everyday life, and that these decisions sometimes are a bit arbitrary. You might go to do an assignment as a journalist and you want to interview two or three people that have, I don't know, a point of view about something, but then you cannot find people who want to talk to you. So what do? You have to just rely on the people that agree to talk to you. But it's very difficult to understand these nuances of media production unless you actually practice things. So for many, many years, and that goes back to 1980s and 1990s, that many educators thought that the best way to teach media literacy was by having students practice journalism and other forms of media production, whether it's taking pictures or doing a small radio broadcast or things like that. But in recent years, because technology is so around us, there's been less tendency towards doing this. And we spend a lot less time getting students to use their hands to produce content. And we observe that quite a bit in that a lot of the media literacy activities that are happening at high schools and at universities do not really involve media production. Obviously, students who are studying journalism or media production have their media production activities, but not at a general student base. So we thought that that would be a good way to go back a little bit about what we know used to work and take advantage of that experience that we have, knowing that when you get students to practice these things, they learn and it helps them better understand how the media works.
You propose direct interaction between students and journalists and media practitioners. We know how cynical journalists can be, so isn't that a bit risky?
Well, I hope that journalists aren't cynical, that they're rather critical. I think that's the distinction that we want to push in this article, and is that it is good to be critical. In fact, there has also been some research that shows that people that have that are critical are also engaged and that they care about things. And then, you know, that being critical also often means that you are knowledgeable. But that's different from cynical, where you just say, oh, I can't believe anything. This is all nonsense. And, you know, you withdraw. So that distinction, I think, is quite important. And I would say that that distinction is also important for journalists, that journalists are critical. That they're critical because they care about certain things, care about democracy, care about truth, and so on, and that they can unearth and can expose problems because they have this sort of critical lens, but that they're not cynical in the sense that they think that nothing can be done about it. So hopefully students can also learn from those journalists that are critical and not cynical.
Mm. Sometimes it's also important for journalists to be close to the audience in some way. We've done some other research that shows that there's a huge gap in how audiences think about news and journalism and misinformation and how journalists think about the same issues. And this huge gap creates a problem, right? Because so you have all these journalists who think that they are doing what they have to do to fight disinformation. They are doing all this fact-checking and all of these activities and all of these hard work that they are trying to do to prevent misinformation from spreading. But then when you talk to audiences, they say, well, that doesn't work for me. It doesn't work for me because A, B, and C. So if you put these two together, right, on the one side, journalists might learn new things about how audiences see their work and how they think about journalistic practice. And then obviously, as Herman was saying, audiences themselves might become a little less cynical by understanding a bit better who journalists are, how do they do their work, and that can help them eventually make better decisions about what information to consume and where to get their news from.
Part of the whole strategy of misinformation is often also to discredit and undermine the legitimate news media. And so this is why we actually don't want to use the term fake news, because this is already in President Trump's first term, where he accused, you know, legitimate news outlets as being fake news as a way to undermine them. That is what we also want to avoid among young people and among media users in general, that if they understand how journalism works, they can be critical of journalism, but they understand how it works and what the conventions are, what the pressures are, and so on, that they will also be able to critically distinguish between good journalism and bad journalism. But when you start and as a sort of a blanket discreditation of journalism and just say, well, it's all nonsense, you can't believe anything the so-called mainstream media tells you, then you are again in cynical territory where you undermine the legitimacy of good news platforms. So again, that distinction between critical and cynical also comes into play when you evaluate the news media.
Is there anything else that we haven't mentioned that you want the listeners to know about misinformation?
There's one thing that we haven't mentioned that's actually very important, and that is South African media consumers actually have some of the highest levels of media trust in the world. There's this very well-known study that happens every year that's done by the University of Oxford at the Reuters Institute, and they ask people, how much do you trust the media? And South Africans are about 57% of people say that they trust the media. That's one of the highest scores, which means that the starting point is actually much better than in other parts of the world. Right? In the US, it's only 25-30% of people who say they trust the media. So there's a good starting point to work with. We just need to make sure that that doesn't go down to a point where it's a lot more difficult to fight misinformation and to create a space where we can all benefit from the work of journalism.
Thanks, Danny Madrid Morales, and my other guest, Herman Wasserman, for a fascinating discussion. And that's it for this first episode of For Fact's Sake, a monthly podcast by CINIA, the Center for Information Integrity in Africa at Stellenbosch University. You can explore more of CINIA's work at the website, CINIA.Africa. That is CINIA.Africa. There you can subscribe to our newsletter. Also, please follow CINIA on Instagram for regular updates. I'm Tebadi Motla. Thanks for listening. We'll be back again next month.